Chapter 20. Small Gods. Religious, said the Dean. Oh dear, said Ridcully. Discworld's wizardry is not terribly keen on religion. Given the history of the Discworld, this is not surprising. One big problem is that on Discworld, gods are known to be real. We list a few later on, but we can set the scene with reference to the god of mayflies. In Reaper Man, an old mayfly is telling some youngsters about this god as they hover just above the surface of a stream.
You were telling us about the great trout.
Oh, yes, right, the trout. Well, you see, if you've been a good mayfly zigzagging up and down properly...
Taking heed of your elders and betters?
Yes, and taking heed of your elders and betters, then eventually the great trout... Clop. Clop.
Yes,
said one of the younger mayflies. There was no reply.
The great trout what?
Said another mayfly, nervously. They looked down at a series of expanding concentric rings on the water.
The holy sign,
said a mayfly.
I remember being told about that. A great circle in the water. Thus shall be the sign of the great trout.
Round-world religions avoid the difficulty of gods that you can actually see or meet or be eaten by. Most of the world's current religions find it best to go the whole hog and locate their gods in a place that is not just outside Round-world the planet, but outside Round-world the universe. This demonstrates admirable foresight, for regions impenetrable today may be a forest of tourist hotels tomorrow. When the sky was an unexplored and unfathomable realm, it was fashionable to locate gods in the sky, or on top of unscalable Mount Olympus, or in the halls of Valhalla, which amounts to much the same thing. But now, all significant mountains have been climbed. People routinely fly across the Atlantic 5 miles up, and reports of encounters with gods are few. However, it turns out that when gods don't manifest themselves in physical form on an everyday basis, they acquire an impressive degree of ineffability. On Discworld, on the other hand, it is possible to run into gods in the streets, or even in the gutter. They also lounge around in Discworld's equivalent of Valhalla, known as Dun Manifesting, which is situated on top of Cori Celesti, a 10-mile-high spire of green ice and grey stone at the disk's hub. Because of the everyday presence of tangible gods, on Discworld, there's no problem about belief in gods. It's more a matter of how much you disapprove of their lifestyle. On Roundworld, deities do not infest the highways and byways. Or if they do so in such a subtle guise that the unbeliever does not notice them. It then becomes possible to have a serious debate about belief, because that's what most people's concept of God rests on. We've already said that on Discworld everything is reified, and that's pretty much the case there with belief. Now, B-space, the space of beliefs, is huge, because people have vivid and varied imaginations, and can believe almost anything. Therefore, G-space, the space of gods, is also huge. And on Discworld, phase spaces are reified, so the Discworld not only has gods, it is infested with them. There are at least 3,000 major gods on the disk, and scarcely a week passes without the research theologians discovering more. Some use props like false noses to appear in religious chronicles under hundreds of different names, which makes it difficult to keep count accurately. Among them are Sefert, the god of cutlery, pyramids, Flatulus, god of the winds, small gods, Grun, the god of unseasonal fruit, Reaper Man, Hat, the vulture-headed god of unexpected guests, pyramids, Offler, the crocodile god, mort and sorcery, Petulia, the goddess of negotiable affection, small gods, and Steikheigel, the god of isolated cow buyers, mort. Then there are the minor gods. According to the Discworld Companion, there are billions of them, tiny bundles containing nothing more than a pinch of pure ego and some hunger. What they hunger for, at least to start with, is human belief, because on Discworld the size and power of a god is proportional to how many people believe in him, her, or it. Things are much the same on Round World, in fact, because the influence and power of a religion are proportional to the number of its adherents. So the parallel is much closer than you might expect, which is what you should always expect with Discworld, because it has an uncanny ability to reflect and illuminate the human condition in Round World. Actually, it's not always human or mayfly belief that matters. According to Lords and Ladies, there were a number of gods in the mountains and forests of Lancre. One of them was known as Herne the Hunted. He was a god of the chase and the hunt, more or less. Most gods are created and sustained by belief and hope. Hunters danced in animal skins and created gods of the chase, who tended to be hearty and boisterous with the tact of a tidal wave. But they are not the only gods of hunting. The prey has an occult voice too, as the blood pounds and the hounds bay. Herne was the god of the chase and the hunted, and all small animals whose ultimate destiny is to be an abrupt damp squeak. When discussing religious beliefs, there is always the danger of upsetting people. The same goes when discussing football, of course, but people take their religion nearly as seriously. So let us begin by acknowledging, as we did towards the end of The Science of Discworld, that all religions are true for a given value of true. We have no wish to damage your beliefs if you have them, or to damage your lack of beliefs if you don't. We don't mind if we cause you to modify your beliefs, though. That's your responsibility and your choice. Don't blame us. But we're shortly going to have a go at science, and then we're going to have a go at art, so we don't think it's fair that religion should get away scot-free. Anyway, whatever your beliefs, religion is an essential feature of the human condition, and it's one of the things that made us what we are. We have to examine it and ask whether Discworld puts it in a new light. If you are religious and you want to feel comfortable about what we're saying, you can always assume that we're talking about all the other religions, but not yours. Some years ago, during Ecumenical Week, Rabbi Lionel Blue was given the Thought for the Day on BBC Radio 4 as part of a series on tolerance. He was the first speaker in the series, and he ended with a joke. "They shouldn't have asked me to start the series," he said, and then explained how the later speakers from other religions would differ from him, and how he would be tolerant about that. "After all," he said, "they worship God in their way, whereas I worship him in his." If you see that this is a joke, as the good rabbi did, but also understand that outside the cozy context this is not, in a multicultural world, a good way to think, let alone speak, then you're already getting to grips with the ambivalent role that religion has played in human history, and with the mental twists and turns required to live in a multiculture. The big problem with religion, for a dispassionate observer, has nothing to do with belief versus proof. If religion were susceptible to scientific-style proofs or disproofs, there wouldn't be a lot to argue about. No, the big problem is the disparity between individual human spirituality, the deep-seated feeling that we belong in this awesome universe, with the unmitigated disasters that organized large-scale religions have at various times, including in all probability yesterday, inflicted on the planet and its people. This is upsetting. Religion ought to be a force for good, and mostly it is. But when it isn't, it goes spectacularly and horribly wrong. In both pyramids and small gods, we see that the real problem in this connection is not religion as such, but priests. Priests have been known to seize upon the spiritual feelings of individuals and twist them into something terrible. The Quisition, in small gods, was hardly an invention. Sometimes it had been done for power or for money. It's even been done because the priest really believed that this is what the god of choice wants them to do. Again, on an individual level, many priests or equivalent are perfectly nice people who do many positive things, but collectively they can have some very negative effects. It is this mismatch that will form the core of our discussion, because it tells us interesting things about what it is to be human. We are very tiny, fragile creatures inside a huge, uncontrollable universe. Evolution has equipped us not just with eyes to see the universe, but minds to hold little models of it within us, that is, to tell ourselves stories about it. We have learned over the millennia to exert more and more control over our world, but we see evidence every day that our ability to control our own lives is extremely limited. In the past, disease, death, famine, and ferocious animals were part of everyday existence. You could control when you planted your crops, but you couldn't control when the rains came, and you might just get jumped by a pride of lionesses while you were bending down to pull up weeds. It is very uncomfortable to have to cope unaided with that kind of world, and many people still have to do so. Everyone feels much happier if they believe that there are ways to control rain and lionesses. Now, the human mind is an inveterate pattern seeker, one that finds patterns even where none exist. Every week, millions of perfectly sane people look for patterns in lottery numbers, oblivious to the absence of any meaningful structure in random numbers. So it's not really necessary for the belief in an ability to control rain or lionesses to correspond to an actual ability to do so. We all know that even when things are under control, they can still go wrong, so our faith in our beliefs seldom gets seriously challenged whatever happens. The idea that there is a rain goddess who decides when it will rain, or a lion god who can either keep you safe from lion attacks or unleash them upon you, therefore has irresistible advantages. You can't control rain, and of course you can't control a rain goddess either. But with the proper rituals, you can hope to influence her decisions. This is where the priesthood comes in, because they can act as an intermediary between everybody else and the gods. They can prescribe the appropriate rituals, and like all good politicians, they can claim the credit when things work out and blame someone else when they go wrong. What? Henry was eaten by a lion? Well then, he must not have shown proper respect when making his daily sacrifice to the lion god. How do you know that? Well, if he had shown proper respect, he wouldn't have been eaten. Ally that to the priest's soon acquired power to throw you to the earthly representatives of the lion god if you disagree, and you can see that the cult of the lion god has an awful lot going for it. People look at the universe around them, and they feel overawed. It's so big, so incomprehensible, yet it seems to dance to a tune. People who grow up in a culture, especially one with a lengthy history and a well-developed set of techniques for making buildings, planting crops, hunting animals, building boats, immediately recognize that they are faced with something that is far greater than they are, which immediately raises all the big philosophical questions. Where did it come from? What's it for? Why am I here? And so on. Imagine how it must have seemed to Abraham, one of the founding fathers of Judaism. He was probably a shepherd, and he probably lived in and around Ur, one of the first true city-states. He was surrounded by the icons of simple-minded religions, gold-plated idols, masks, altars. He was wildly unimpressed by them. They were trivial things, small-minded. They did not begin to measure up to the awesomeness of the natural world and its stunning power. Additionally, he was aware that something much bigger than him was running that world. It knew when to plant crops and when to reap them, how to tell whether rain was on the way, how to build boats, how to breed sheep, well, he would have known that bit, how to have a prosperous life. Even more, it knew how to pass all this knowledge on to the next generation. Abraham knew that his own tiny intelligence was nothing compared to this majestic something, so he reified it and gave it a name, Jehovah, which means that which is. So far, so good, but then he made a simple but intellectually fatal error. He fell for the trap of ontic dumping. Nice phrase. What does it mean? Ontology is the study of knowledge. Not knowledge itself, just its study. One important way to firm up new knowledge is to invent new words. For instance, when you make an arrow, someone has to produce the sharp, pointy thing that sits at its business end. They chip it from flint or cast it in bronze. Either way, you can't go on forever referring to it as the sharp pointy thing on the end of an arrow. So you cast around for a metaphor And you remember that the thing that sits at the business end of a person or animal is called its head. So you invent the term arrow head. You have now dumped the knowledge of what the flint or bronze gadget is into a name. We say dumped because for most purposes you don't need to recall where the name came from. Arrowhead, no hyphen, has now become a thing in its own right, not a property possessed in relation to an arrow. The human mind is a storytelling device, a metaphor machine. Ontic dumping comes naturally to creatures like us. It's how our language works, how our minds work. It's a trick we use to simplify things that would otherwise be incomprehensible. It is the linguistic analog of a political hierarchy, as a way for one person to control millions. As a side effect, ontically dumped words wallow in associations. We are seldom conscious of these, except when we occasionally stop and ask something like, "What on earth does gossamer mean?" Then we rush off to the dictionary and discover that it probably, no one ever knows these things for sure, comes from goose summer. What's that got to do with fine threads that float on the breeze? Well, in a summer when geese abound, a good summer, you find a lot of these fine spider silk threads hanging in the air. Subconsciously, though, we are all too aware of the dark associations several layers down in the ontic dumping hierarchy. So words which ought to be abstract labels are smeared all over with their own, often irrelevant, stories. Abraham, then, was overawed by that which is, and he ontically dumped it into a word, Jehovah, which quickly became a thing, indeed, a person. That's another of our habits, personifying things. So Abraham made the tiny step from "there is something outside us that is greater than ourselves" to "there is someone outside us who is greater than ourselves." He had looked on the burgeoning extelligence of his own culture, and before his eyes, it turned into God. And that made so much sense. It explained so much else. Instead of the world being like it was for reasons he couldn't understand, even though that greater something clearly understood it perfectly well, he now saw that the world was like that because God had made it that way. The rain fell not because some tawdry idol rain god made it fall. Abraham was too smart to believe that. It fell because that awesome God, whose presence could be seen everywhere, made it fall. And he, Abraham, couldn't hope to understand the mind of God, so of course he couldn't predict when it would rain. We have used Abraham here as a placeholder. Choose your religion, choose your founder, adapt the story to fit. We're not saying that we know that the birth of Judaism happened the way we've just explained. That was just a story, probably no more true than Winnie the Pooh and the honey. But just as Pooh in the rabbit hole teaches us about greed, so Abraham's ontic dumping points to a plausible route whereby sane, sensitive people can be led from their own private spiritual feelings to reify a natural process into an unfathomable being. This reification has had many positive consequences. People take notice of the wishes of unfathomable, all-powerful beings. Religious teachings often lay down guidelines, laws, commandments for acceptable behavior towards other people. To be sure, there are many disagreements between the different religions or between sects within a given religion about points of fine detail. And there are some quite substantial areas of disagreement, such as the recommended treatment of women, or to what extent basic rights should be extended to the infidel. On the whole, however, there is a strong consensus in such teachings, for example, an almost universal condemnation of theft and murder. Virtually all religions reinforce a very similar consensus of what constitutes good behavior, perhaps because it is this consensus that has survived the test of time. In terms of the barbarian tribal distinction, it is a tribal consensus, reinforced by tribal methods such as ritual, but none the worse for that. Many people find inspiration in their religion, and it helps instill a sense of belonging. It enhances their feeling of what an awesome place the universe is. It helps them cope with disasters, with exceptions, mainly related to specific circumstances such as war. Most religions preach that love is good and hatred is bad. And throughout history, ordinary people have made huge sacrifices, often of their own lives, on that basis. This kind of behaviour, generally referred to as altruism, has caused evolutionary biologists a great deal of head-scratching. First, we'll summarise how they thought about the problem and what kinds of conclusion they have reached. Then, we'll consider an alternative approach, originally motivated by religious considerations, which looks to us to be far more promising. At first sight, altruism is not a problem. If two organisms cooperate, by which in this context we here mean that each is willing to risk its life to help the other, there doesn't seem to be a good word for to be altruistic. To altru? Then both stand to gain. Natural selection favours such an advantage and reinforces it. What more explanation is needed? Quite a lot, unfortunately. A standard reflex in evolutionary biology is to ask whether such a situation is stable, whether it will persist if some organisms adopt other strategies. What happens, for example, if most organisms cooperate, but a few decide to cheat? If the cheats prosper, then it is better to become a cheat than to cooperate, and the strategy of cooperation is unstable and will die out. Using the methods of mid-20th century genetics, the approach pioneered by Ronald Elmer Fisher, you can do the sums and work out the circumstances in which altruism is an evolutionary stable strategy. The answer is that it all depends upon whom you cooperate with, whose life you risk your own to save. The closer kin they are to you, the more genes they share with you, so the more worthwhile it is for you to risk your own safety. This analysis leads to conclusions like, it is worth jumping into a lake to save your sister, but not to save your aunt, and certainly not to save a stranger. That's the genetic orthodoxy, and like most orthodoxies, it is believed by the orthodox. On the other hand, though, if someone has fallen into a lake, people do not ask, excuse me, sir, how closely related are you to me? Are you by any chance a close relative? Before diving in to rescue them. If they are the sort of people who dive in, they do so whoever has fallen into the lake. If not, they don't. Mostly. A clear exception arises when a child falls in. Even if they can't swim, its parent is then very likely indeed to plunge in to the rescue, but probably would not do so for someone else's child, and even less so for an adult. So the genetic orthodoxy does have a certain amount going for it. Not much, though. Fisher's mathematics is rather old-fashioned, and it rests on a big and very shaky modelling simplification. In Fisher's day, this simplification was a great idea, because it made it possible to do the sums. Nowadays, it's a bad idea for the same reason. You can do them, but you can't put any faith in the answers. It represents a species by its gene pool, where all that matters is the proportion of organisms that possess a given gene. Instead of comparing different strategies that might be adopted by an organism, it works out what strategy is best on average. And inasmuch as individual organisms are represented within its framework at all, which they are, only as contributors to the gene pool, it views competition between organisms as a direct me versus thee choice. A bird that eats seeds is up against a bird that eats worms in a head-to-head struggle for survival, like two tennis players. And may the best bird win. This is a bean-counting analysis, performed with a bean-counting mentality. The bird with the most beans, energy from seeds or worms, say, survives, and the other does not. From a complex system viewpoint, evolution isn't like that at all. Organisms may sometimes compete directly, two birds tugging at the same worm, for instance, or two baby birds in the nest, where direct competition can be fierce and fatal. But mostly, the competition is indirect, so indirect that compete just isn't the right word. Each individual bird either survives or not against the background of everything else, including the other birds. Birds A and B do not go head to head. They compete against each other only in the sense that we choose to compare how A does with how B does, and declare one of them to be more successful. It's like two teenagers taking driving tests. Maybe one of them is in the UK, and the other is in the USA. If one passes and the other fails, then we can declare the one who has passed to be the winner. But the two teenagers don't even know they are competing, for the very good reason that they're not. The success or failure of one has no effect on the success or failure of the other. Nevertheless, one gets to drive a car and the other doesn't. The driving test system works that way, and it doesn't matter that the American test is easier to pass than the British one, as we can attest from personal experience. Evolutionary competition mostly works like the driving test, but with the added complication that just occasionally it really is more like a tennis match. From this point of view, evolution is a complex system, with organisms as entities. Which organisms survive to reproduce, and which do not, are system-level properties. They depend as much on context, American driving test versus British, as on the internal features of the individuals. The survival of a species is an emergent feature of the whole system, and no simple shortcut computation can predict it. In particular, computations based on the frequencies of genes in the gene pool can't predict it, and the alleged explanation of altruism by gene frequencies is unconvincing. Why, then, does altruism arise? An intriguing answer was given by Randolph Ness in the magazine Science and Spirit in 1999. In a word, his answer is overcommitment, and it is a refreshing and much-needed alternative to bean counting. We have said more than once that humans are time binders. We run our lives not just on what is happening now, but on what we think will happen in the future. This makes it possible for us to commit ourselves to a future action. If you fall sick, I will look after you. If an enemy attacks you, I will come to your aid. Commitment strategies change the face of competition completely. An example is the strategy of mutual assured destruction as a deterrent for nuclear war. If you attack me with nuclear weapons, I will use mine to destroy your country completely. Even if one country has many more nuclear weapons, which on a bean-counting basis means that it will win, the commitment strategy means that it can't. If two people, tribes or nations, make a pact and agree to commit support to each other, then they are both strengthened and their survival prospects increase. Provided it is a sensible pact, we leave you to invent scenarios where what we've just said is wrong. Ah yes, that's all very well, but can you trust the other to keep to the agreement? We have evolved some quite effective methods for deciding whether or not to trust someone. At the simplest level, we watch what they do and compare it to what they say. We can also try to find out how they have behaved in similar circumstances before. As long as we can get such decisions right most of the time, they offer a substantial survival advantage. They improve how well we do against the background of everything else. Comparison with others is irrelevant. From a bean counter's point of view, the correct strategy in such circumstances is to count how many beans you gain by committing yourself, compare that to how many you gain by cheating, and see which pile of beans is biggest. From Ness's point of view, that approach doesn't amount to a hill of beans. The whole calculation can be sidestepped at a stroke by the strategy of overcommitment. Stuff the beans. I guarantee that I will commit myself to you no matter what. And you can trust me because I will prove to you and keep proving it every day that we live that I am committed at that level. Overcommitment beats the bean counters hands down. While they're trying to compare 142 beans with 143, overcommitment has wiped the floor with them. Ness suggests that such strategies have had a decisive effect in shaping our extelligence, though he doesn't use that word. Commitment strategies give rise to complexities that may be a selective force that has shaped human intelligence. This is why human psychology and relationships are so hard to fathom. Perhaps a better understanding of the deep roots of commitment will illuminate the relationships between reason and emotion and biology and belief. Or to put it another way, perhaps that's what gave us an edge over the Neanderthals, though it would be difficult to find a scientific test for such a suggestion. When humans overcommit in this manner, we call it love. There is far more to love than the simple scenario just outlined, of course. But one feature is common to both. Love counts not the cost. It doesn't care about who gets the most beans. Altruism, cooperation and love among humans are not the only examples of evolutionary overcommitment. As the librarian well knows, a banana is much better suited to being eaten by an orangutan than it needs to be. The rest of the fruit kingdom doesn't come close. What's in it for other fruit, like the tomato, is that its seeds pass through the animal and are dispersed, complete with a built-in pack of fertilizer. A bean-counting tomato could reduce its level of suitability and still ensure that its seeds, rather than those of the competition, were propagated. The juiciest tomatoes used to be from the plants growing at the sewage farm. But an overcommitted banana avoids the need to test such fine points. By going over the top, losing its seed-producing capacity entirely, and relying on humans to propagate it, it ensures that it wins so comfortably that no competitor even gets a look in. And by refusing to play the bean counter's game, it wins outright, which is a very religious, spiritual, and uplifting message, and sound evolutionary sense. What more could we ask? Quite a bit, actually, because now it all starts to get nasty. The reasons, however, are admirable. Every culture needs its own make-a-human kit to build into the next generation the kind of mind that will keep the culture going, and recursively ensure that the next generation does the same for the one that comes after that. Rituals fit very readily into such a kit, because it is easy to distinguish us from them by the rituals that we follow but they don't, which can be applied so overpoweringly that the people who aren't us aren't anything. See the Imperial China parody, the Agatian Empire in Interesting Times, and a number of round-world cultures too. Being them is quite a step up by comparison. It is also an excellent test of a child's willingness to obey cultural norms by insisting that they carry out some perfectly ordinary task in an unnecessarily prescribed and elaborate manner. Now, however, the priesthood has got its ideological toe in the cultural doorway. Rituals need someone to organize them and to elaborate them. Every bureaucracy builds itself an empire by creating unnecessary tasks and then finding people to carry them out. A crucial task here is to ensure that members of the tribe or village or nation really do obey the norms and carry out the rituals. There has to be some sanction to make sure that they do, even if they're free-thinking types who'd rather not. Because everything is founded on an ontically dumped concept, reference to reality has to be replaced by belief. The less testable a human belief is, the more strongly we tend to hold on to it. Deep down, we recognize that although not being testable means that disbelievers can't prove we're wrong, it also means that we can't prove we're right. Since we know that we are, that sets up a tremendous tension. Now the atrocities begin. Religion slides over the edge of sanity, and the result is horrors like the Spanish Inquisition. Think about it for a moment. The priesthood of a religion whose central tenet was universal love and brotherhood systematically inflicted appalling tortures, sick and disgusting things on innocent people who merely happened to disagree about minor items of belief. This is a massive contradiction, and it demands explanation. Were the Inquisitors evil people, who knowingly did evil things? Small Gods, one of the most profound and philosophical of the Discworld novels, examines the role of belief in religions, and Discworld undergoes its own version of the Spanish Inquisition. One twist is that on Discworld there is no lack of gods, however few of them have any great significance. There are billions of gods in the world. They swarm as thick as herring roe. Most of them are too small to see and never get worshipped, at least by anything bigger than bacteria, who never say their prayers and don't demand much in the way of miracles. They are the small gods, the spirits of places where two ant trails cross, the gods of microclimates down between the grass roots, and most of them stay that way, because what they lack is belief. Small Gods is the story of one rather larger god, the great god Om, who manifests himself to a novice monk called Brutha. In the citadel at the heart of the city of Qom, in the lands between the deserts of Klatch and the jungles of Hawonderland. Reuther's attitude to religion is a very personal one. He runs his own life by it. In contrast, Deacon Vorbis believes that the role of religion is to run everybody else's life. Vorbis is head of the Quisition, whose role is to do all those things that needed to be done and which other people would rather not do. Nobody ever interrupts Vorbis to ask what he is thinking about, because they are scared stiff that the answer will be you. The great god's manifestation takes the form of a small tortoise. Reuther finds this hard to believe. I've seen the great god Om, and he isn't tortoise-shaped. He comes as an eagle, or a lion, or a mighty bull. There's a statue in the great temple. It's 7 cubits high. It's got bronze on it and everything. It's trampling infidels. You can't trample infidels when you're a tortoise. Om's power has waned because of a lack of belief. He tests his strength by silently cursing a beetle, but it makes no difference, and the insect plods away unperturbed. He curses a melon unto the 8th generation, but with no evident effect. He inflicts a plague of boils on it, but all it does is sit there, slowly ripening. He vows that when he returns to his rightful state, the tribes of beetle and melons will regret not responding, for on Discworld, the size of a god is determined by the strength and amount of belief in him, or her, or it. Om's church has become so corrupt and powerful that the fearful belief of the common people had been transferred to the church itself. It's very easy to believe in a red-hot poker, and only Reuther, simple soul, still truly believes. No god ever dies because there is always some tiny pocket of belief remaining somewhere in the world, but a tortoise is pretty much as low as you can get. Reuther is going to become the 8th prophet of Om. His grandmother would have made it 2 generations before, but she was a woman, and narrative imperative forbids female prophets. Vorbis's job is to ensure that all Omnians remain true to the teachings of the great god Om, which is to say, they do what Vorbis tells them. The presence on the Discworld of the god itself, causing changes to all the old teachings and generally making trouble, is not greatly to Vorbis's taste. Neither is the presence of a genuine prophet. Vorbis is faced with the Inquisitor's spiritual dilemma, and resolves it in the time-honored manner of the Spanish Inquisition, which, basically, is to tell oneself that torturing people is fine because it's for their own good in the long run. Reuther has a much simpler vision of Omnianism. It is something for individuals to live by. Vorbis shows Reuther a new instrument that he has made, an iron turtle upon which a man or woman can be spread-eagled with a firebox inside. The time it takes for the iron to heat up will give them plenty of time to reflect on their heresies. In a flash of prophecy, Reuther realizes that its first victim will be himself. And in due course, he finds himself chained to it, and uncomfortably warm, with Vorbis watching over him, gloating. Then, the great god Om intervenes, dropped from the talons of an eagle. One or two people who had been watching Vorbis closely said later that there was just time for his expression to change before 2 pounds of tortoise, travelling at 3 meters per second, hit him between the eyes. It was a revelation. And that does something to people watching. For a start, they believe with all their heart. The great god Om now is truly great. He rises over the temple, a billowing cloud shaped like eagle-headed men, bulls, golden horns, all tangled and fused into one another. 4 bolts of fire whir out of the cloud and burst the chains that fastened Reuther to the iron turtle. The great god declares Reuther to be prophet of prophets. The great god gives Reuther the opportunity to make some commandments. The prophet declines, having decided that you should do things because they're right, not because God say so. They might say something different another time. And he tells Om that there will be no commandments unless the god agrees to obey them too. Which is a new thought for a god. Small Gods has many wise words to say about religion and belief, and it makes the point that in their own terms the Inquisitors believe they are doing good. Fyodor Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov has a scene in which the Grand Inquisitor encounters Christ and explains his point of view, including why Christ's renewed message of universal love couldn't have come at a worse time and will only cause trouble, just as the presence of Brüther, a genuine prophet, was not at all to the liking of Deacon Vorbis. The Spanish Inquisitors' justification of their actions was philosophically convoluted. The purpose of their tortures was straightforward. It was to save a sinner from eternal damnation. The tortures of hell would be far worse than anything the Inquisitors could inflict in this world, and they would never stop. So, of course, they were justified in using any means whatsoever to save the poor soul from destruction. They therefore believed that their actions were justified, and in accordance with Christian principles. Not to act would have been to leave the person concerned in danger of the terrible fires of hell. Yes, but what if they were wrong in this belief? This is the convoluted bit. They weren't quite sure about their religious position. What were the rules? If they failed to convert one tortured heretic, would the inquisitors burn forever? If they converted one heretic, would their souls be guaranteed a place in heaven? The inquisitors believed that by inflicting pain and terror without knowing the rules, they risked their own mortal souls. If they were wrong, it was they who would be immersed in the eternal flames. But they were willing to risk this enormous spiritual danger, to take upon themselves all the consequences of their actions, should they turn out to be wrong. See how incredibly magnanimous they were being? Even as they burned people alive and hacked them limb from limb with red-hot knives? Clearly, something is wrong. Dostoevsky solves his own narrative problem by having Christ respond the way his own teachings would lead him to. He kisses the Inquisitor. This is an answer of a kind, but it doesn't satisfy our analytical instincts. There is a logical flaw in the Inquisitor's position. What is it? It's very simple. They have thought about what happens if their belief that their actions are justified is wrong, but only within the frame of their religion. They have not asked themselves what their position would be if their religious beliefs are false, if there is no hell, no eternal damnation, no fire, and no brimstone. Then their justification would fall to bits. Of course, if their religion is wrong, then its doctrine of brotherly love could also be wrong. It doesn't have to be. Some parts might be fine, others nonsense. But to the Inquisitors, it is all of one piece. It stands or falls as a whole. If they are wrong about their religion, then there is no sin, no God, and they can cheerfully torture people if they want to. It really is a nasty philosophical trap. This is the kind of thing that happens when a big, powerful priesthood latches on to what started as one person's awe at the universe. It is what happens when people construct elaborate verbal traps for themselves, trip over the logic, and fall headlong into them. It is where holy wars come from, where neighbor can inflict atrocity on neighbor merely because this otherwise reasonable person goes to a church with a round tower instead of a square one. It is the attitude that Jonathan Swift caricatured in Gulliver's Travels, with the conflict between the big Endians and the little Endians, over which end of an egg to slice into when eating it. It is perhaps why so many people are turning to unorthodox cults in an effort to find a home for their own spirituality. But cults run the same risk as the Inquisition. The only safe home for one's personal spirituality is oneself.